And welcome to a Saturday night. Ah, the chair is warm from Dr. David Viscott, who spent the last 3 hours doing it to you and all of us again. How wonderful. Hope you got his new book. His new book is something else, The Viscott Method. But we have a method for you tonight. It's a method of how to enlighten you, bring you some astounding information that perhaps you don't know anything about, bring you up to date on some information we've talked about before. We'll be a bit scientific tonight, but we have one of the greatest scientists in the country, I think. He's a scientist, but he has a way of talking about very scientific things in a very earthy way that you and I can, well, if I can understand him, I figure you can understand him. His name is Tom Bearden. Tom has been deeply involved in the research of many of our weapon systems, our computer systems for doing all their maneuvers so we don't have to send all the armies out to sea. He knows exactly what's going on in the world of science. Tom, welcome aboard. Are you there, Tom? Tom.
Yes, I said, thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, I didn't have you turned on.
That was... Oh, okay.
I was glad to have you there. Tom has electrified this audience over the last few years that we've been doing it on the Open Mind Show. I suppose, Tom, that I get more mail about you and more requests for you to come on than anyone else that we've had, and we've had some really good bringers in here.
And well, I certainly appreciate that, Bill, and I certainly appreciate the audience writing those letters.
They have written the letters. You've electrified us about free energy devices, about the scalar interferometers. You have another thing on your mind tonight. Let's get scientific. What's happening with the weather? Is it being manipulated? Is it being controlled? Or is this nature doing its thing all by itself?
Well, in my opinion, it's being strongly influenced by outside devices and outside means, particularly the weather over North America itself.
Let's get into that, because it's affected a lot of people. Lives have been lost here in the United States of America.
Okay, let me, to get into the thing and exactly how it's being done, and before I get through tonight, I want to give the audience some things they can look for in the sky and see. I will give them some very specific signatures that they can see for themselves when this is being done. And if you see these particular signatures in the sky, you can rest assured you're looking at weather engineering that's being done from far around the world, probably from the Soviet Union.
I would suggest, Tom, if I may break here in just a second, that this is an important broadcast. I think it's a very important broadcast. And if you have a tape recorder handy, I would like for you to get your tape recorders rolling. And if you have a friend, I think you should call them and have them listen in, because you're going to hear something tonight that will astound you. And we're rolling tapes here, Tom, but go right ahead.
Okay, to start with, I'm going to have to give you just a little preparation so that you understand in a way what's being done and how it can be done. So let me start out with the very basic thing of what a scalar wave is. If you take two ordinary waves and you put them together 180 degrees out from each other, what you can result from that, what you can have when you get through with that, you can have a wave or a pulse in space-time itself. What you do is you squeeze space-time just like you'd squeeze a sponge rhythmically, but you do not create the normal kind of electric field and magnetic field in the wave that we normally have in our textbooks. If you do it correctly, you don't have to add just two waves. You could add 10. The thing is, as long as the vectors sum to zero, very precisely, you have created a zero vector wave, and that makes it a scalar wave.
Now, a vector wave,
Tom, for simple purposes, just look at it as if you were rhythmically squeezing a sponge and unsqueezing it. And what you're doing that to is space-time itself with this kind of wave. That's what it does. Now, that is really the original wave that Tesla discovered back shortly before the turn of the century in his Colorado experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this kind of a wave can be easily made in the laboratory and it can be proven to exist, and you can use it. But I want to tell you a couple of things you can do with it. If I take something like a pencil beam radar, something that transmits a very narrow beam, and if I cross two of these beams, that is, two of these scalar beams, not the normal beam that you make from a normal radar, but this particular kind of beam, in the little area where they cross, the interference produces ordinary energy, ordinary electromagnetic waves. You can stick something in there and you can certainly detect that. It looks like the normal stuff. The difference in this interference pattern is that we are now putting in the zeros and creating the non-zeros in the middle. The way we look at it with normal wave interference is we put in the energy and the out-of-phase interference can create the destructive zones or the zeros. We do it just backwards here. We put in the zeros, and in the middle, in this interference zone, we create the ordinary energy. So what we're saying is, with this kind of a wave, which a normal detector will not detect, you can stick an antenna right up in the middle of it if you've got a good one, and you will not see a detection on your oscilloscope. But in the interference pattern, which may be 1,000 miles away or even 10,000 miles away, in that narrow area where they cross, or you can make wider beams and have a wider area, you will produce ordinary energy, ordinary electromagnetic interference zones. Now, that really is the secret of Tesla's wireless transmission of energy at a distance. Because everything you put in on the other end comes out in that interference zone. You don't lose a single bit of it. There is no square loss involved in this process. Now,
no transmission cost whatsoever.
No loss in the transmission at all. You get all of it out on the other end that you put in on this end. If you put 2 kilowatts in this end, in the interference zone out there, you have 2 kilowatts of energy.
But the power companies don't like that, Tom. They like to sell transmission of energy.
Well, it's true. We've just told you how to do it without the losses that occur in the lines. And, of course, that was Tesla's wireless transmission without energy. He is the one that really discovered how to do that.
You know something that I have found out, Tom? I want to keep everybody up to date. We've been talking about Tesla here. I have found out that a lot of people, when I talk to, I mentioned Nikola Tesla, they don't know who I'm talking about.
Well, that's true, and it's not accidental. Nikola Tesla, of course, given a thumbnail sketch here, is the man who almost single-handedly gave us the electrical 20th century. He gave us the multi-phase power system, the AC power system we use today.
The alternating current.
Right? The alternating current. He gave us the rotating field that made our motors and generators possible. He invented the radio, not Marconi, which all the books have in it. The Supreme Court, 1943, overthrew the Marconi patents, and, of course, Tesla... It was a Tesla apparatus that Marconi used to do his experiment.
So our radio station is operating off of a Tesla apparatus.
That's correct. He also built the first guided automatons. You know, he had a guided boat that he showed and demonstrated, guiding it radio controlled. And he anticipated intercontinental ballistic missiles. He also, at his death, had a paper that described a particle beam weapon, for example, which would have worked. And he had, of course, discovered a more fundamental electromagnetic wave than we've been using in our theory today.
Which is what you call the scalar
wave. What I'm calling the scalar wave.
He also had the death ray, and he demonstrated it.
Yes. Now, my purpose here is to show that this kind of a wave can be used to do some things like influence the weather over an entire hemisphere. Okay, the way you would do this is as follows. Suppose I had two or more transmitters which were producing beams of the scalar wave energy I'm talking about, which the beams cross over North America. They all converge and cross over the United States and Canada. Okay, in the interference zone, you would see what looks like a standard wave interference pattern. You would see rows of waves crossing other rows of waves. Now, as a matter of fact, that exact pattern a friend of mine and I have seen here over Huntsville, Alabama, running from north to south as far as the eye could see, the clouds were divided into absolutely even rows, as if you had a plowed field in the sky. And if you turned at right angles and looked in the other direction, from horizon to horizon, you had another series of what looked like absolutely even cloud rows.
I have a series of photographs of that cloud structure over Los Angeles of last week.
Good. Now, if that's the formation of the thing. Now, this particular phase of the weather intervention over North America started, they started adjusting this stuff in shortly before the death of Brezhnev. Now, the signatures of adjusting it in are as follows. What you will get when you're starting to deposit and pop out energy here and there all over, at certain nodal points where you get pretty good pop out, dump of energy, you will get low-level atmospheric booms. Not the big booms, but the low-level little micro-booms. And you had those going in Alabama. You had them going down in Florida and off the coast of Florida. And at various spots throughout the country, you had these things going. And reported in various articles in the paper. That's what it was. You were having dumps, sudden little cracks or dumps of energy into the atmosphere, which are making these popping sounds. The other thing that you can have them doing is you can have them being dumped into the ground, and so you can have a series of little microquakes, particularly when they're in areas where you normally don't get those things. Now, on the microquakes in the ground, you will pick them up with a seismograph. They won't look all that much different from the small microquakes that you get in nature anyway, but the micro airquakes will be significant. Now, they apparently took about 3 months or so to adjust this whole network in and get it all set and working right to their satisfaction. And then I'm convinced personally, it's my personal opinion, and I'm convinced that they are responsible to a great degree for giving us our beautiful flood that we had in the early spring of 1983 that caused a lot of flood damage here and there everywhere.
When you say they, you are speaking
of
the Soviets.
I'm talking about the Russians. This is a Russian weapon, and it's coming from Russia, and it's being used on us over North America, in my opinion.
This is not to be confused with a ELF transmitter.
No, sir. This is not ELF. Now, understand, if you want to disguise the thing, you can put a little ELF in it, ordinary stuff that you can pick up, and you'll think you're looking at the Russian woodpecker, and you won't know about the other stuff. Now, it turns out that water vapor, or water in the air, which is not really vapor, it's in droplet form, where they tell us it forms around a little particle of dust. You have a water drop, and if you're high enough in the atmosphere, of course, it freezes. You have a little particle of ice around the dust drop. But these little particles of water or particles of ice in the atmosphere are very interactive with this scalar wave stuff. They act as little interferometers, and they do react to the scalar wave stuff. And so the water itself in the air, in the form of clouds, does move and form patterns when very strong scalar wave engineering is being done, or energy of this nature is being created in that region, when you have the interference pattern. Okay, the first thing we did, we had an actual sighting, a friend of mine and I, over Huntsville. We saw this grid pattern actually being adjusted in, and it persisted in the sky for over half a day. Now, that's a peg point for number one. That fit very well in a time frame with the after the spring floods and all, getting ready for adjustments in the winter weather. Okay. After they got it adjusted and gave us the floods, the way that you can swing a cloud mass is once I have it adjusted in over an area, if I now turn my transmitter slowly, and I can turn them in any pattern I figure out to do, it's as if I move slowly that whole grid pattern. I can, and with phasing, I can make parts of it move. And so I can do things like reaching up and capturing the pressure areas and moving the jet stream itself down so that the classic pattern emerges. What we had in all this bad weather, we had this big jet stream dip very far down, coming in over from California, coming in over Texas and all, and then roaring up along the ridge back of the northeast, and so it roared through the south and on up parallel to the eastern coast. And we had storm after storm after storm roar through with that pattern along the bent and deviated jet streams of the upper atmosphere. California, for example, if you established a few blocking patterns, you had storms which came and hammered at the coast and hammered and hammered and hammered. coming the same way. So that gave California a good show. Now, another pattern that you will find forming, and let's see, I'll have to give you a visualization here to get a hold of what I'm talking about. I want you to imagine now a checkerboard where we've laid everything off in little squares. Now, in the center of, that's the wave diffraction pattern sitting up in the sky over North America. In the center of each little square, we're creating ordinary energy. You can put a detector in there, you can detect it. And by the way, the underground net went bananas in the United States. People were calling me from all over with the ELF and other kinds of frequencies they were picking up. And in fact, what they thought was the U.S. government was doing this. And I told them that was nonsense. The government had not built a bunch of transmitters all over the U.S.
Explain, whenever you say underground net, Tom.
The people who are a little bit off the orthodox pattern, track, and who do measurements out in the field and measure the Soviet woodpecker signals and measure what kind of signals out there and who's trying to do what to who.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to make some sense out of it and trying to put it together and find out what's going on.
Private citizens.
Private citizens.
Connected.
And they picked up these this energy, which is in the form of frequencies in the middle of each one of these grid zones. They picked that up all over the country. And so they thought that somebody had built an enormous number of transmitters throughout the U.S., but that's not the case. But it gives you the same effect as if the Russians had been permitted to come into the United States, as if they had built a transmitter in the center of each one of these little grid zones. In other words, I've been calling that a virtual transmitter. The reason is, you have ordinary energy there, just like comes out of any ordinary transmitter. You can measure it, you can detect it, and it has real effects. And so we had that sitting all over the United States. Now, the next thing that to visualize in each little square, visualize now a little mountaintop sticking up, and that's your energy sitting in that square. So what you're looking at on the checkerboard now is all of these squares with all of these little mountaintops, these little almost triangular-shaped things or cone-shaped things sitting all over it. So you're looking at a whole bunch of little cone-shaped things sitting all over North America, and that represents the energy in sitting in each grid. Okay, around each one of those cones, depending on how they're transmitting, the clouds will react. There are two kinds of reactions that will occur, and you can look up in the sky for yourself, and if you're lucky, you'll see one of these patterns. I've seen about seven so far. I've been successful in photographing one. I finally had a camera with me when another one appeared over Huntsville, and I got that one's picture. But the signature to look for, the first one, is around where the cone of energy is, the clouds will form about two-thirds of a circle, about 5 miles in diameter. A little thin line of clouds will form this very unusual, almost circle, about two-thirds of a circle. And then radially, straight away from where the center would be, there will be long, thin lines of clouds running 15 or 20 miles. And you're looking at something that looks like almost like the old rising sun symbol of Japan in World War II. Only a piece of it is missing. You're looking at maybe a half or two-thirds of a circle with these radials running directly away. These long, thin lines, very straight, of clouds. Very unusual formation.
Going out in all directions from this little...
Radially from the support would be the center of that little two-thirds of a circle. Okay, mm-hmm. Now, when you see that, that is not a natural formation. Now, if you've looked at the sky very much, you realize that clouds do form striated clouds. That's a well-known type of cloud. There are many types of striated clouds. We are not talking about those normal striated clouds at all. This is very abnormal. You can't mistake it once you ever see it. That's the first pattern. What I call the giant radial. It's just a circle, almost circle, about 5 miles in diameter, very thin line of clouds making about two-thirds of a circle. Then radially away from that, straight lines, very straight and very long, 15 or 20 miles long, radiating away from what would be the center of that circle, straight away in the radial direction. Now, if the energy is even stronger, what you'll have is the energy will spill out past the checkerboard border in one of these where you're putting the interference in, and between two of these conical places or two of the things that are forming the giant radials, two of them will get together. When that happens, the inner circle will disappear. And so you have the same pattern you just had with a giant radial coming out, and on the other end of it, there is another giant radial pointing back into a center. Only the circle in the center is now missing. In this case, the line of clouds is just a little bit fatter. It's about three times as thick as the other line of clouds. And now you're looking at two of them, which will be anywhere from 20 to 30, even 40 miles apart, which will be moving along in the sky. The one I saw was moving, as best I could estimate it, about 25 miles an hour. And what you're looking at is you're looking at a part of the grid where the energy is being formed, and you're looking at a very, very slow rotation of this occurring by movements on the transmitters coming from Russia. And what we're doing with that is we're capturing entire cloud masses and moving them right along to control the weather. And we're, of course, changing the pressure in the air, and we can do weather engineering that way. Now, I took off from a trip to California. I took off from Huntington Beach, and I had to leave very early to catch the airplane. This was in December, and it was prior to that extreme cold snap we had that broke so many records in the country. As I left Huntington Beach, there was a giant radial sitting right over Huntington Beach. As I got on the airplane then, finally, and came on out to coming into Memphis, when I was about 400 miles from Memphis on a United flight, sitting up at about 30,000 feet was an absolutely flawlessly perfect giant radial. I flew right over it. We were up at about 35,000. And so I was about 5,000 feet above this thing, looking right out at it, an absolutely perfect specimen, and I didn't have a camera with me. But anyway, on the same trip, I saw two of them very far apart in the United States, one halfway across the United States from the other. I've seen three or four here over Huntsville, Alabama, and I saw one in Florida in October on a trip with another person there. We saw a giant radial sitting off down in Florida. The next morning, we saw one in southern Alabama, which preceded quite a bit of violent thunderstorm activity, including some tornado activity in South Alabama. If you twist the weather currents around, you're going to get some tornadoes in the right season. So you can augment the tornado activity. You can augment the rain activity. You can move great masses of clouds, great cloud banks, over great cloud covers over a large part of the United States. And you can actually change the jet stream itself and change the pressure areas. And then by very slow rotation, so that you don't slip out and lose the stuff you're capturing halfway around the world, you can move those cloud masses and influence the weather substantially. And in my opinion, that's been going on over our head, certainly since shortly after the death of Brezhnev. There was considerable activity with giant radials and the virtual transmitters and the grid network shortly before that very, very unusual cold snap, which broke so many records in so many cities all across the country. 1983 was a very unusual weather year. Certain records were really broken. For example, I don't have all my information collated together just yet, but I can give you a few things. One of the things was the highest barometric pressure ever recorded was recorded in 1983. Another thing that happened that was unusual, of course, was the coal records in quite a few cities, some 75 or 100 of them, were broken. All-time records were broken in that December cold snap we had. Let's see, another thing that was very unusual, the turbulence or the amount of swirling of the air in the atmosphere was some 10% or so, 8 to 10% higher, according to the Weather Service, than has been noted. And so we had some very unusual things occur, some very unusual extremes occur in the year 1983, closely correlated with this very unusual activity of adjusting in over North America a gigantic grid of virtual transmitters which can be used to control the weather. So, in my opinion, what I'm describing to you is the evidence, admittedly somewhat circumstantial at this point, But certainly the giant radials can be photographed. I now have photographs of one. The grids can be photographed, and certainly they can be observed. I'm encouraging everybody to start observing the clouds and look for those formations. If you see those formations, let somebody know. Let me know the sighting that you've seen them. Draw a sketch. If you've got a camera, take a photograph. If you can't let me know, let Bill Jenkins know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'd like everybody to load their camera, get it ready, keep your eye in the sky, take a picture of it, note what time it was taken, or if you don't have a camera, at least write me and say, I saw it here and I saw it there. Get it to me, and I'll get it on to you, Tom. Because I have seen, myself, those circles and the radials going out for them, not knowing about this sort of thing. I said, isn't that odd? But we do have them over Los Angeles.
Now, they're real clever over California. The one in Huntington Beach that morning, they had just cut the power out of it, and it was beginning to dissipate. But because I was out so early, I was out just after the crack of dawn, I got to see the thing. But an hour later, if you'd looked at the sky, if you hadn't known that there'd been a real solid one there, you know, you'd have said, well, it's just a very unusual shaped cloud, set of clouds sitting up there, because it was dissipating from the winds aloft after the power had been cut. Now, the other thing I'd like to point out is everything I'm describing is directly related to the work of Wilhelm Reich,
yes,
the cloudbuster and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What a cloudbuster puts out is a peculiar kind of radiation, which is really what I've been calling the zero vector radiation or the scalar radiation. And what it's causing is a peculiar kind of resonance between the scalar currents in the ground and the scalar currents in the atmosphere. And as William Wright clearly showed, and other people who have showed after him have shown with cloudbusters, you can, for example, influence with that simple device and that kind of resonance, you can influence gigantic masses of clouds, and you can shape the weather. And you can also do it by the transmitters I'm discussing here, and you can do it halfway around the world, which is what I think is being done to us. So anyway, that's a sort of a cook's tour, a short tour through the weather engineering over North America. I am going to give a paper on this summer at one of the conferences, and the paper will be published and available from John Ratzlaff as soon as I get the time to finish writing it. I'm gathering the rest of the data for it now, and I will print the pictures in there of the giant radial that I took here over Huntsville. And if I'm lucky, or if somebody else sends me one, we'll have other pictures of these giant radials as well.
Well, we hope everybody gets their camera out and starts looking for those, and we'll describe those again. Tom, do you want to take a break with me for just a second? We'll do a couple of things and get right back to weather engineering, which is going on above our heads at the present time by our dear friends the Soviets. Be with one of our distinguished scientists in this world. He's been involved with the weapons analysis of the Soviet Union for the Pentagon. He's been involved in developing some of our more formidable weapons systems here in the United States. He's a man who knows exactly what he's talking about. And he kind of riveted us here, Tom. You hear for the last 40 minutes talking about the manipulation of weather over the United States by the Soviet Union. Told us some things to look for where you can see it happening yourself. And certainly we've been feeling it here in California. You've been feeling it there in Alabama where you're talking to us from tonight. And it's getting to be a serious problem.
Yes, it is. And until we, you know, bring this thing out strongly enough that we have enough people seeing it, photographing it, the idea here is if we get enough people reporting what's happening in the sky, you'll get the regular scientists in looking at it, and you'll get the government looking at it, and they'll realize that something unusual is going on.
The government is not looking at it right now, you're telling me?
Well, as far as I know, not much of the government, let's say, is looking at it. Not nearly enough.
Why is that, Tom?
Well, it's understandable. The things I'm talking about here, the scalar wave, for example, is not in the present scientific theory. At best, what I'm talking about would be regarded as highly controversial.
Exotic.
Now, If we can move it close enough to where we get it into the highly controversial area, where it's accepted but highly controversial, and by the way, we're doing some very strong things to try to get it to that point. At that point, then, you'll find a lot of normal, orthodox scientific agencies will begin looking at it. The moment they do that, the moment we get the sharp young graduate students and the sharp professors in our major universities looking at this thing, at that moment, we're going to make an awful lot of progress real fast. And that's what we've got to get happening. We've got to get them turned on to it. And we've got to get them doing the phenomenology experiments. There are thousands and thousands of phenomenology experiments that have to be done before we'll fully understand this area. Only a few of those have been done at the present time.
How many transmitters do the Soviets have that are doing this, do you think?
I wish I knew. If I had to estimate, you know, I'd estimate somewhere like a dozen.
That's
purely a guesstimate. It could be many more than that, or it could even be fewer.
They have to use an enormous amount of energy. Where are they getting it?
Okay, there's two sources of the energy, of course. If you look at normal sources, you could get it from a power plant. You could tie your local hydroelectric power plant. The Soviets are pretty good at magnetohydrodynamics, and at least in some of their literature, they have shown that they've had entire power plants run by magnetohydrodynamics that have been tied up to transmitters. For example, in some of the translated Russian papers I was looking at, they have admitted transmitting something like 18 or 20,000 amperes through the entire crust of the Earth. And so we know that in that kind of transmission, they're using very, very powerful transmitters.
Well, they use extremely powerful ones up around Riga. Those are the ELF transmitters.
Yes. Now, the things that we've been calling the woodpecker signal, and the woodpecker name, as you know, Bill, comes from just the sound that the chirp signal makes when you detect it. It sounds nothing more than a woodpecker's bill hitting a block of wood. And so it was promptly dubbed the woodpecker signal because of that rapid chirp, rapid drumming noise that it makes. Those transmitters, I've seen various estimates on how powerful they are. Some of the estimates run up as high as 100 megawatts. Some even estimate a little higher than that. But whatever they are, they're extremely powerful transmitters. The other thing is, the thing that we're detecting from them is only the normal component. Now, when you use a lot of power in something like that, there's an efficiency with which you would get scalar waves. In other words, you wouldn't get 100% pure scalar waves. You'd get a lot of noise, a lot of spillover, and the other stuff. Now, that part of it, I think, it's like what's above the water we can detect, but what's below the water we can't see. The majority of the stuff that they're transmitting is below the water, so to speak. It's in the scalar range, and our normal detectors don't detect that. Now, since we're on this subject, and since I know that some people in the audience who are listening to me are technical folks, I want to say one other thing just for the technical folks, and I'll be very brief. I want to tell them how to build an extremely sensitive scalar wave detector. The way you do that is you use the very strongest magnet that can be made. Use a superconducting magnet. Make yourself a PU that's 30 or 40,000 Gauss. Understand, a strong magnet is about 12,000 Gauss, a very strong one. And I'm talking about making an extremely strong field. In that pole or in that field, you have a warp in space-time. And it's strong enough that a scalar wave, if you look at that as a longitudinal vector, to the space-time background, it appears to have a lateral component. What that all means is if you stick a normal wire in there and hook it up to a resonant circuit with an oscilloscope, you can detect the scalar wave as an ordinary Maxwellian electromagnetic wave. So you just put it in an extremely strong magnetic field, as strong one as you can make in the laboratory, stick a straight wire in there or a coil or any other kind of detector you want to stick, an ordinary detector, leave one end of it hanging open, tie the other end to a resonant circuit that feeds an oscilloscope, and you can look at all the scalar waves you want to see. So when you do that, you'll find that something like the woodpecker is very much more complicated than what you can find with a normal spectrum analyzer or with our normal detectors. In other words, they can put stuff down below the ocean, in the common language I'm using here now, the stuff that our normal detectors don't see. They can put currents, they can put resonant signals, They can put patterns and multiple patterns. The interesting thing about those kind of patterns that you put in that way that we do not see with our normal detectors and we don't know are there, in the human body, there are highly nonlinear detectors that are very precise. Up until about 3-4 years ago, the orthodox scientific view was that the only thing that electromagnetic waves really did to tissue was when they were strong enough to heat it. And if they heated the tissue and hurt it, then that was what damage they did. Simply how much energy was deposited in a cubic centimeter of flesh or something like that was the way they looked at it. Energy deposition. Today, through some very forward-looking scientists who pounded away and done the experiments until they found it and proved it, and it's now been accepted, we now know that a biological system has very, very sharp trigger frequencies in it. And as well pointed out, lo, these many years ago, by my good friend Dr. Robert Beck out there in California, I think he's been fully vindicated in the fact that those triggers do exist and they are very precise. The literature now bears out everything Bob was saying quite some time ago.
Well, I hope he'd get on the air with us, but he's still shy.
Okay, well, that's fine. I understand why. He's got good reason. But he's a capital fellow, and he, like I say, a lot of the things that he's been doing years ago, and that a lot of people put a lot of pressure on him because he was doing that, he's being fully vindicated at the present time. Now, the scalar wave, if there's a nonlinear part of the body that has one of those sharp biological triggers, let's say down in a cell, and it's quite nonlinear in there, when in the scalar wave part of it, that is, that's below the ocean, the hidden part, if you have that exact frequency in there, and that's absorbed in the body, and you hit that sharp trigger, you get an effect far beyond the very minuscule amount of energy you might be putting into the body. And so, if you know about those biological triggers, and you know how to hit them, you can hit them from Riga and Gomel or wherever else you're putting the transmission of this kind of energy out. You can hit them in a U.S. target population. You can hit them in us, sitting here in North America.
Are you saying then, with transmitters in the Soviet Union, they're able then to affect the bioenergetics of a human body?
That is correct, and halfway around the world. I'm saying exactly that. And the scalar component of it, the normal, conducting shield, the normal Faraday shield, will not work. It won't even slow the scalar wave down because the free electrons don't react to the scalar wave. It goes right through them. It'll only react to something that's nonlinear. You have to build a very nonlinear device to shield against that. You can shield against it, but you can't shield against it the way we normally do shielding. And so the normal kinds of shields that we have don't even slow it down. It goes directly on into the body and hits its target if they, in fact, put that frequency in there. And so that sort of thing can be done to the population or the target population over in, and you can do it real easy in the zone where you interfere the waves and you make them into normal energy waves there. You can add a component which will hit the weaker biological triggers that way. You just hit it with normal energy. Now, the interesting thing about this interference pattern, when you do the interference, the energy which rises that we're forming in the middle rises from the microscopic region. That is, it rises from points in space. It does not come through the space like you would think of a wave going through water. It's as if it arose at each point in the water. So anything in that region has electromagnetic energy forming in it at the smallest point, in the atoms, in the nuclei, in the, if it's made of molecules, the material is, it's in the molecules. And so you can have very, very intense point heating occur, a point deposition of energy in an object this way. With that effect, for example, with transmitters in the laboratory putting out even kilowatts of power, very well focused down into those micro points, you can shatter, for example, giant steel bolts or do things like that because you can get severe deposition of energy in very small volumes of material throughout a narrow section of material. And that becomes a very lethal thing when you do that. And so you can get very localized heating. By the way, psychokinesis, when the human being is able to bend or break metal, it's done exactly by the same mechanism. The two cerebral hemispheres of the brain can act as scalar projectors, and they can produce rays or beams or waves which interfere in a local region. And if you're holding a stainless steel bar or a stainless steel fork and you get one of these bends or breaks in there, that's the way it's being done. And by the way, I have a friend who I don't think wants his name mentioned, so I won't mention him. But I have a friend who's doing some very excellent scientific work in that area. What he's doing is he'll use something like a stainless steel rod. He'll buy two of them, and he'll take to a place where the a person does psychokinetic bending. And he will have one of the rods bent psychokinetically. The other will be retained as a control sample. They will then take both of these samples back to the laboratory and section them. And he will look at the cross-sections of both of them under the electron microscope. The interesting thing is, the normal control rod, you see the grain pattern just like you would see in a normal piece of metal. But in the rod which has been bent or broken, if you will look at that on the electron microscope, you will see the grain structure has been drastically changed at the microscopic level. It looks like you're looking at the surface of the moon. You see intense heating in little puddles and little holes, just like you were looking at the pockmarked surface of the moon. A completely abnormal thing. And by the way, that's a thing you can't fake on your belt buckle either.
No, it's
there. You cannot change the grain structure of the metal in that fashion by any sleight of hand trick. And some of the people that are doing these are little old ladies in tennis shoes. In fact, they make the best benders.
They really do. And we have one, Greta Woodrue. I think you know Greta.
Yes.
She shrinks the metal.
Yes, indeed. You have other physical effects that let you know that it's not done on the belt buckle or by sleight of hand.
By the way, in about 2 weeks, I'm going to go down and learn how to walk on coals. And I suppose I'm using that left and right hemisphere to do that.
Yes, indeed. Since we're on that subject and since we're talking about scalar interferometry, we may as well cover the mechanism by which that's done. What happens here, I'll have to cover one other effect of this. In that interference pattern, if it were perfect, if you were making perfect scalar waves, in that interference pattern, the energy that's in there would be totally trapped. In other words, a photon could not be radiated out of there. It would be locked as if it were in a bottle. And I've been calling that an energy bottle. Now, in the real world, you don't make a perfect one. So some of the energy escapes and radiates away as photons, as electromagnetic energy radiating away. But if you have a pretty good bottle, anything that comes in that bottle, in its range or in its frequency range, or even close, is going to get locked up in there and isn't going to get out. And so you can do a very amazing thing with that. For example, you can place that kind of a bottle on an object, say like a steel object, and you can be putting in the power now from a distance. Understand, this would be in the laboratory. You would have two beams coming in here, which are crossed where the object is. The energy which you're putting in on the other end of the beams is appearing in the bottle, and so you would have a metal object in here heated white hot. It would be glowing. Because it's not a perfect bottle, you'd be able to see it. You'd be able to take a radiometer and actually measure the temperature to prove how hot it is. You have a white hot bottle, white hot metal in that bottle. Now, if you turn the power off on the other end smoothly, then the energy in the bottle, you are creating the energy at a distance. That energy will just simply die right down. And you can turn it off and reach in instantly and pick up an absolutely black object that is not hot at all. It's absolutely cold.
Hmm.
So you can just sort of suck all the energy right out of there. Or you can annihilate the energy is another way to look at it. That has been done. And that, of course, can be quite useful. Now, used as a trap, if you have an energy bottle that's placed, let's say, under the bottom of the feet, under the soles of the feet, or around the skin of the feet, if you have such a bottle in the human body, and that bottle is correctly made so that heat energy, which is electromagnetic energy, entering it gets trapped, then that foot can walk over hot coals and not be burned. And that is exactly the way firewalking is done. Firewalking is demonstrated widely throughout the earth. Many cultures, many people do it. And as you were pointing out, some of the people here in the United States have now taken up showing that you can do firewalking.
Well, there's a group here in Santa Monica that does it. About 80% of the people that go through about a 4.5-hour course, which is a mind-quietening technique more than anything else, not only walk on them, they pick them up in their hands.
That's true, and you'll see them holding them for several seconds, and you'll see the coal glowing red hot. And if you look at the temperature of the coal and you're looking at it in the hand, and the Leyden frost effect can only be pressed so far, you realize that you couldn't possibly be looking at that. And I'd make your prediction. This effect will grow, and you're going to find more and more people learning to do it.
I'm taking a number of firemen.
For your handling fire, I recommend great care, and I don't recommend anybody trying it by themselves at all.
Well, I'm taking a number of firemen down there. If there's anybody that needs to learn how to handle fire, I think it would be the firemen.
Yes. But it is a real phenomenon. It can be demonstrated, and I think you'll see it being demonstrated from now on, just so that, you know, people will become aware of the fact that this phenomenon is real.
Well, I just got back a couple of weeks ago from Fiji, and I videotaped them walking on those hot coals, hot rocks they were, and they were so hot that they would almost instantly ignite a fresh palm leaf whenever you threw them down on them.
Yes, the phenomenon is very impressive. Now, you know, given an energy bottle created by the two cerebral halves acting as a scalar projector, scalar interferometer, and a transmitter mode, the human being has the capability of doing that. Now, you understand what we're talking about is a human being has the capability to be a beautiful high wire walker and do all the fancy tricks on the high wire. Now, one normally does not develop that ability. That does not mean it's a fake. We sing.
Tom, the music means we're going to take a break. I don't believe this first hour has gone. The callers are lining up with some very, very incredible questions for you. Let's take a break for the 11 o'clock news.
Okay.
And we'll be right back right after. All right, Tom, you want to talk to them, and we'll talk about free energy a little bit later, okay?
Okay, fine.
All right, let me give the numbers for those that do want to get in and talk to Tom, because particularly I'm interested in you calling in if you've seen these strange weather patterns that Tom has talked about, the two-thirds of a circle formed in the sky with about 5 miles in diameter with long, thin clouds extending out in a radius from it, like a radio formation. If you've seen those around the Los Angeles area, we would like to hear from you. The numbers in Los Angeles...
Starter, I just wanted to say, when you were mentioning about the walking on fire,
yes,
that you didn't say, kids, don't try this at home.
Yeah, don't do that at home.
Okay. No,
that's very important.
Very important, because it takes a lot of mind... exercising and attitude straightening and a lot of things to get that done.
Yeah, and that sounded very interesting. This really isn't a question. It's more or less a statement. You know, you were talking about you were interested in people that might have seen those formations in the sky.
Yes.
I bet you a lot of people have seen those, but they more or less just passed them by as like jet streams or, you know, jet exhaust. Would that be possible to mistake them for something like that or formation jet exhaust?
Well, what you'll find is people see it and they say, gee, what an unusual cloud.
Right.
And they don't think that much about it because we don't normally go around looking at the clouds and trying to compare this cloud with that cloud to find out what types of cloud are in the sky, you know, what the normal types of clouds are. And so we have other things on our mind, and after a while it just fades away. We remember we saw an unusual cloud and that's it.
Yeah, I'm really amazed by what you're saying. As a matter of fact, it's the first time I've heard about this. My next question was the documentation to substantiate your claim. I've never seen it, or at least I've never heard, you know, Dr. George giving the weather saying we might have scattered rain from the Russians or anything. Now, you were saying that you're going to be making a paper or whatever it may be. How much of the public on a percentage do you think actually knows about this?
Well, I'm sure I don't know on a percentage basis. I can tell you what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
I'm trying to make it as public as possible. At John Ratzlaff at the Tesla Book Company, and Bill will give you the address, I'm sure.
Sure.
Maybe we can give it on the air here.
Certainly can.
I've written a series of papers on electromagnetics, and the part four that John publishes, I gave some of the mechanisms by which this stuff occurs. And just at the end, I mentioned the weather engineering. Now, the next paper will be on weather engineering by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do is make the stuff public so that everybody does know about it, and then maybe you will tune in and have your local weatherman make a comment on it.
In Tom's previous papers, Dave, you'll find a rather detailed description of the scalar wave, how you can make your own scalar wave transmitter, in fact. And I would recommend that you write John Rodsliff up there at Tesla Book Company. You have that address at the tip of your fingers? I know it's on Magnolia.
Yes, it's Tesla Book Company, 1580 Magnolia.
Right.
And that's Millbrae, California, 94030.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think you're really doing a service to the American people. More people need to know about this. This isn't something that... you read in the National Enquirer, you're definitely qualified to do this because, I mean, you can give an example and your average Midwestern mentality, I wouldn't say, besides not caring about it, they just don't know about it. Or unless if you saw it, like if you were watching Family Feud and they were asking a question, you know, someone's altering our weather, you know, the person wouldn't go Russian, you know, wouldn't turn around and go, survey set, you know.
Right.
Russians, two people in the audience would probably say that.
Well, what happens you do that, the eyes go to the top of the head and they want to get on to the next soap opera, and it's sort of a sad commentary of where media has led the American mind.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the Bill Jenkins Show is one of the few shows that will allow somebody to mention a subject like that and go into the detail that's necessary for you to understand it.
Yeah, I understand that.
Most of the people that will call you and ask for a comment on something like this will say, you know, give it to me in 3 minutes flat. And right. That's impossible.
You can't do that. Hey, no. I know you got a lot of other callers. I have one more question. You're talking about the Russians doing this as a possible offense or defense, whatever you call it. Can't this be used for countries that have extreme droughts to produce rain for their crops?
Oh, absolutely. The fact that they weaponize this has nothing to do with the fact that the scalar technology has a marvelous array of things that can be done for the benefit of humankind.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to see is a widespread development of it for the benefit of humankind. In medicine alone, it can do spectacular things.
I would suspect, Tom, that this research was really generated out of a need to move weather in the Soviet Union into their agricultural areas. They've had a lot of trouble over there. They've had to buy a lot of wheat from the United States, and after they found out they could do it, they found out it was a weapon system and started playing with that, too.
Right, that's unfortunate, but it seems like that's what the more interest is in, rather than preserving life, destroying it. One last quote, put a little light on the subject. I was just thinking if the French did it, maybe it might start raining Perrier water. But it was nice talking with you, and you're very informative. And I've got your address, and I will be writing into that. I just wanted to say to all the other listeners that they should write in on this and be more to open to human beings like yourself.
Well, thank you very much, Dave.
Very good. Have a good night now.
Okay, Dave. Good for you. Randy, you're on.
How are you doing? Good evening, Tom and Bill.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I'd appreciate it if you'd recap a little bit, if you'd follow me while I frame this so that I understand it. Are you saying, in effect, that these transmitters in the Soviet Union send out currents that cross, in a sense, like an XY graph, and that those points can be plotted anywhere in the country or the world, for that matter?
Yes.
And at that point, that nodal point, these radio clouds form. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, what controls, then, the distance in the atmosphere from the ground? How high these... For example, you said you were flying over 35,000. You could see them below you. What controls that distance?
Okay, you've asked me one of the questions at the present time I do not know, and I don't mind telling you when you hit something I don't know.
All right.
I don't know how you control how high it is, how you get it out of the ground or up in the atmosphere and control the altitude. That I do not know.
Okay, now, my other question about that, with the incredible amount of general electromagnetic radiation in the atmosphere from everything from, you know, microwave ovens and, you know, ship-to-shore transmissions, everything, TV stations, wouldn't there be a breakup just from the enormous amount of EMR that would cause all these clouds to sort of scatter rather than have a coherency to them?
Well, from the normal stuff that you get, by the way, there are scalar currents in the Earth, and it's my theory that the normal striations that you get in great number in large masses of clouds are caused really by interactions between the scalar currents in the Earth and resonance with the clouds. I think the Earth is already doing scalar weather engineering.
naturally formed?
Naturally. I think that these particular signatures and the things I'm talking about here are abnormal. They are unnatural. They are man-made. And certainly the adjustment in of the network was picked up and detected here in this country. And,
yep.
And the fact that these little virtual transmitters exist throughout the country, that fact was picked up and measured by the people who are out there in the field measuring it. And they reacted to that very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So certain parts of this thing were detected. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it you have to piece together like piecing a jigsaw puzzle together. But if you do know something about the scalar electromagnetics, then it all makes sense. It all adds up, and then you see the signatures in the sky, and you know what you're looking at.
Now, does the... What was I going to say? The system the government was going to set up, the Pentagon, to transmit across, I don't know, seven states to the oceans to control the submarines?
That's
is that
normal
similar?
ELF-type transmission. Yes, we know that normal ELF will... that's extra low frequency, you know. You get the frequency down very low.
Right.
And by very low, we might mean 30 hertz, for example. We, you know, somewhere in that region. 60 hertz, 50 hertz, 30 hertz. If you get down to that region, we know that wave will go through the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
The normal electromagnetic wave of that frequency will go on down through the ocean to the sub. Now, the problem you have there is you don't have very much data rate. It takes you forever to send a message of any length to that submarine. And so, you know, what people would like to have would be something up in the megahertz band where you can send the message very quickly.
Now, we abandoned that project, as I understand, because different local governments were complaining.
I don't think we've abandoned the ELF at all.
Mm. No, we haven't. It's running full tilt.
Oh, I thought a number of the states were absolutely opposed to having it run across their lines.
Well, certainly that's been true. That's
yeah.
correct. But the project is still ongoing.
I see. Now, what about the U.S. intelligence community? Do they not even look at these... items? Or do they and simply are mute about it?
Okay, that's a very important point that you raised, and let me address that just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence analyst is, let's say he's an electrical engineer, or he's a physicist, or, you know, a technically trained person, but his training is from the orthodox scientific community. Now, scalar waves and scalar technology does not exist in the normal textbook, nor is it taught at the normal university. Okay, if you have one of these people or a group or an agency that gets interested in this area and says, maybe there's something to it. Now, they're spending taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing they have to do, they have to turn to the orthodox scientific community. They try to turn to the best people they know. And they say, tell us about scalar electromagnetics so we can train our analysts and so they'll recognize the stuff when they see it. And the orthodox scientific community doesn't have scalar electromagnetics in it, so it says there is no such thing. It is all a bunch of hooey. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
exist.
They think you're a nut in this whole theory.
Well, of course. That's a kind word.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, the intelligence analyst then, since he's spending taxpayer money, is certainly not going to go against the expert advice that he gets from the scientific community. And by the way, justifiably so. I'm on his side in that thing, even though it goes against me.
Can't blame him.
That's right. He would not spend taxpayer money on every will-o'-the-wisp that comes along. What I'm trying to do is say that this is not a will-o'-the-wisp. This is real. It's there. It can be measured and can be detected if you build the detectors. And I can tell you enough about it so that you can go in the laboratory and start developing the detectors and so that you can actually build some of the effects and see that it's real. And then you take over from there.
No,
so that's what I'm trying to do, and it has to be attacked in this fashion so that enough of the orthodox scientific community changes, then we'll have the intelligence analyst change, and all of a sudden intelligence will be full of it.
Is the orthodox community looking at this now? I mean, do you have any
parts
people?
Of it are mm-hmm. by people who are being very careful that their scientific reputation doesn't get ruined. In other words, they're doing it in secret.
Yeah.
We have a lot of private citizens that are working on it, Randy, all over the country. Some of them that are in government, but they don't want to, are in academia, but they don't
they can't
want
to acknowledge it publicly.
They don't want to disperse their reputation in case it goes wrong. But nevertheless, they're sitting out there and beginning to work on it. And Tom is one of the men who has enough to him where he can stand out there on the limb and nobody's going to saw it off after him because his word is pretty good.
I appreciate
the main advantage, you know, being very honest, the main advantage I have is that I really don't have any orthodox scientific reputation. Nor do I have any that I have to establish or defend. And I'm perfectly willing to live by the laboratory experiment. If the experiment keep showing that we can have this kind of wave and we can have these kind of effects, then the scientific method says you have to change the theory. If the experiments do not show that, then what I'm saying would be wrong, you see. And I'm perfectly willing to abide by that. That's called the scientific method. That's the way we ought to do it.
So you need general support within the scientific community, willing to look at these data and willing to at least consider the possibility of changing their whole framework.
Yes, one of the problems, you see, is that nobody in the scientific community, no source of funding at the present time that I know of, is going to fund this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that I'm able to do a little bit of this kind of work in my private life is because I'm able to make a decent living at another kind of skill and pay the grocery bill with that. And I'm able to afford to do a little bit of this in my private life. And so I do what I can.
If we ever
get it being believed, we will have funding sources and we'll have a lot of work done and we'll have a lot of progress real quick. And that's what we've got to get to. We've got to get it into the universities.
I'll be following this. If you can just touch on one more thing, I'll let you go. When you talked about the storms in South California last year that pounded Malibu, tore down the houses, people were saying that this is something that happened 200 years ago, I think it was, a number of meteorologists were speaking about that this is a natural occurrence, and the only thing that's unusual is that we haven't been around in terms of recorded meteorological activity to have that documented, but that actually all of these rains and the way that they actually came in much more onshore than before was a natural occurrence that is, in a sense, cyclical, but over a long period of time, and they explained it that way, at least most of the...
I thought it was an interesting explanation, being that never been recorded before in the past. How do they know that it happened?
Exactly. Now, are you saying that they plotted, in a sense, the Soviets, assumingly, over California, these points, and then these points caused severe buildups of... go on with it. You explain.
Okay, what I'm saying is they put radiation, waves, in a beam which has a certain width,
mm-hmm.
and by the time that thing gets over North America, it's pretty wide. And so over the United States and Canada, they established multiple beams like this, interfering with each other. The interference pattern is that grid I was talking about,
right,
placed over North America.
Okay.
The one that I'm saying that a friend of mine and I saw sitting up in the sky, clear as a bell, right here over Huntsville, Alabama. Now, once they had the grid in and adjusted and got through with all the controls and the phasing and everything, at that point, they had a system set up where they could do weather engineering. Now, that adjustment did occur just about, they finished that thing about towards the end of February or so, or in the middle of February of 1983. And so they had that thing in place in time to influence the weather. Now, understand, they don't completely control the weather. They just influence and divert it. The more power they put in, the more diversion, the more influence they can get. And so that's what I think really happened. It's the degree of the storm you got and the misshapen path of the jet stream that's significant. It's not the fact that, nature never produces a violent storm. Of course it does. And I don't think we saw any storms more violent than anything's ever been produced. We didn't see that. We certainly saw the highest barometric pressure that's ever been recorded in 1983.
Well, they don't have a button that says rain and it'll rain. They can just move jet streams and change weather patterns, and we know how weather would ordinarily respond under those circumstances if you could put it in a bottle.
Well, listen, I really appreciate all the research you're doing, and I'll be following it. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. Nice talking to you.
Okay, Tim, you're on the line.
Well, thank you, Bill. I want to thank both of you and your guest for verifying the fact that I'm not crazy. Because I believe I've seen these patterns. It really struck me. I was driving on the freeway, and I heard you describe the cloud pattern as being like the old Japanese rising sun symbol.
Yes.
And I had seen that several times.
Whereabouts?
Well, I'd seen it in Iowa, just outside of Ames.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also seen it in Bakersfield. And the latter instance was... in about, I would guess, August last year, which is odd for Bakersfield, because it's not very cloudy there, but it's an agricultural area, and the same outside of Ames. And Ames I saw back, I would guess, was about March or April. And what struck me about it was how rapidly it appeared. You know, and in the Midwest, you're used to these odd weather patterns, because the weather's real strange there anyway. But to see it in that perfect symmetrical pattern. And what I was wondering about was, is there any idea whether, like, animals have a sense of when this is going on or not? And I say this only because, you've heard of these studies that say that animals, you know, can predict earthquakes and the like through their behavior. Because in both instances, you know, before I had noticed anything going on in the sky, I had noticed something with some animals that were around, you know, on the farm there, too. For example, in Iowa, we have a very large, you know, chicken house, and they just went berserk, literally. You know, just a frenzy of activity for seemingly no reason, and then suddenly I would look up and notice that here was this cloud pattern. And I was wondering whether they are more sensitive to these scalar wave type vibrations than maybe humans are, or what, or whether you've noticed that in your research.
Yes, animals are more sensitive to scalar waves than humans. Humans react to it, but they react unconsciously. What they tend to do is change their mood. They get irritable, or they change their emotions, or, you know, they get all moody and all upset and everything. Or they develop some symptom like fatigue or a twitch or something like that. So humans develop, react unconsciously. Now, the animals are much closer to their unconscious than the humans, and so the animals react much more directly. Just as they react to the scalar waves emitted from the pressure just before an earthquake, they would react in an area where there's a very strong scalar radiation of this type. And I'm very glad you noticed that. That's a significant point.
Because, well, you know, I really couldn't help you, because, like I said, I've always heard the animals are very sensitive to changes like that, but I have never seen anything like that. And not just, you know, when I was in Iowa with all the chickens, but when I was, you know, in Bakersfield, and we had some dogs and some goats, and it was the same thing.
Well, take your camera with you and snap that thing if you see it again.
Well, I can't. My dog Briggs is with me all the time now, and if his ears go up, I start scanning the sky. I mean, I just never knew what I was looking at. I just, you know, put it down to odd weather phenomena, like that one caller said earlier. Most of us, we just don't know it. You know, we don't know what we're looking at.
Well, now we've got a tip-off from Tom, and let's keep our eyes open.
Oh, I will indeed. Now, you know, I thank you for opening my mind on this, and now maybe it'll open our eyes, too.
All right, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Bye-bye.
Much. Bye-bye. Appreciate the call.
Thank you, Tim. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
It's happening over in Iowa, too. We're going to be back with Tom Bearden in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins.
Tornadoes and floods and all of that.
We have Warren on the line. Warren, welcome aboard.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I'm interested in the receiver. I'm a graduate student at the University of California down in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And in our lab, we have a superconducting magnet that we typically run at 40 kilogauss, but it will go up to 80 kilogauss.
Well, then you're ready to...
Yeah.
Detect scalar waves.
Well, I'd like to talk with Mr. Bearden for a couple minutes about how I go about doing it. What it is, it's got about a 1.5-inch diameter bore, and it's about 15 inches long. That's the center of the magnet.
Okay.
And we'll run it for like 3 days at a stretch. Okay? Now, I'm wondering if I can use that to try to see these things.
With the kind of strength you can get out of it, when you get up to 40 kilogauss, which is the area you want to get to, that or higher, to get to some sensitivity, what you should try to do is this. Regard the detector that you're putting in there as just an antenna. It could be a straight piece of wire. It could be a coil or whatever. Just leave one end of it open. Don't put a closed circuit. Leave one end open. From the other end, run it to a tuned circuit outside the device. And that tuned circuit tuned to the frequency you wish to look to, resonant frequency.
About what frequencies would you...
Okay, the Soviet stuff is generally down in the communication band, so we're talking, you know, from 5 to 30 megahertz, although we've seen them going up above 40 megahertz. Now, I'll tell you this in advance, but I'd rather not discuss it too far. You're going to find intelligent signals, if you get it going right, that nobody knows exactly where they're coming from.
Yes, now...
But what you have to do to shield out the normal junk, you need a Faraday cage which will shield out the normal electromagnetics around the thing. So put the thing inside a good shield, like, you know, just a good copper conducting plate.
No, it's in a metal... It's in a metal door.
Yes, okay, that should be sufficient. Any good metal cage, and ground the cage, should give you a Faraday shield for the normal stuff. In other words, your normal TV station, your normal radio station, their waves are going to be grounded in that shield, and inside there you should have a silence zone. Mm-hmm. And that's where you want your superconducting magnet, and that's where you want the detector laying on it, and you can run the wire then out to your tuned circuit and run that to the oscilloscope and take a look at it.
Will these be observable about any time, or are they on?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing.
Oh, will they be on any time, or are they on some of the time and off?
Right now, the Soviets are on some of the time, so keep monitoring. And if they cut back on, you can take a normal shortwave detector, and you can find out when the woodpecker is on.
Yeah.
And so you can look for correlations between the woodpecker and what you're able to detect on this.
Yeah.
And keep changing your frequency. Sweep around with the frequency until you hit some activity.
Yeah, okay.
Now, the moment you detect something, if you have a well-shielded apparatus, you know immediately that you are not detecting normal waves because they're dying on the shield.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that can get through that shield is going to be the scalar wave. And so what you're looking at is a scalar wave when you see that on the oscilloscope.
Yeah, and it's...
Now, let me explain, since you're technical, let me explain why this thing detects.
Okay.
When you have a magnetic pole... And I don't know yet which one is the strong one, which one is the weak one, but it's either the North Pole is an increase in the intensity of the vacuum flux, or it's the South Pole that's the increase. One is an increase, one's a decrease. And so from one to the other, you have a delta flux. You have an actual vector flux in the virtual state, that is, in the vacuum. You really do have a virtual flux. Now, what a magnetic field really is in the vacuum is as follows. It represents the circulation inside the electrostatic scalar potential. And from a position of high intensity flux, which means a lot of circulation, to a position, the other pole, which would be lower circulation, below ambient circulation, that's what a strong magnetic field represents. And that also represents a curvature of space-time. And if you have a horizontal vector, which is what a longitudinal wave, like a scalar wave is, if you enter a curved space-time region, which is where you put your detector, to that curved space-time detector, it's been at an angle in curved space-time to your longitudinal vector, the longitudinal vector now appears to have a transverse component, and that's what you're detecting. You're detecting a normal wave. In other words, the curvature of vacuum translates the scalar wave with respect to that detector into a normal Maxwellian Hertzian wave that you can detect.
Could I ask you just two more questions? All right.
I want you to make them quick. We've got a lot of people lined up here.
Okay. You say it won't make any difference if it's just a straight wire going along the field.
Yes, it's just an antenna you're putting in there.
And the second question is, if I look at it randomly, about how long do you think would be a fair amount of time to look?
Oh, boy. Well, the physicist that built one of these things, that he wouldn't give me the exact construction details, but he shared with me the principle by which it's built, which is what I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm.
He did not give me the orientation, but he implied that as soon as he got the thing cranked up, he was getting signals all over.
Okay. Well, I'll give it a try.
But anyway, keep scanning around. I know the Soviet activity is intermittent right now, so you may come on in an off period, but you can tell that by listening on your short wave.
Mm-hmm. A matter of fact, for what we do, it should be obvious if it's there, because we'll more or less be doing that anyway in the course of our experiments, looking for something else.
Right.
Okay. If I find it, I'll call Bill.
Good. Good luck to you. I hope you find that thing.
Yeah, keep me informed, and I'll get it on to Tom.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Okay, we have Craig on the line. Craig?
Good evening, Bill.
Yes.
It's an honor to speak with you, Tom. Before you get away from us, could you give us an address if you'd be willing to correspond with some of us where we could reach you?
Yes, I can give you my post office box.
Okay.
My post office box is 1472.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Huntsville, Alabama, 35807.
Mm-hmm. Are you still putting out specula?
Well, I'm not connected with putting it out, but it's still coming out.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine is the editor now, Art Barrett, and they've been well behind, but he's just put out one, and he has another one in the hopper right now, which I've just looked at today.
Okay. I want to mention some things as fast as I can here that, for the skeptical listener, that pretty much prove what you've been saying. A little kitchen chemistry. You can produce your own standing waves in your house to take a bowl of water, set them on the vibrating engine of your car or something vibrating, and if the vibration's just right, the ripples will appear to be standing still like the strobe light effect.
Right.
And that's standing waves, and the same principle applies to air and radio waves.
Exactly.
And also, listeners might have heard the astronomers talking about radio interferometry. So, you know, interference patterns work on an astronomical scale, and not just in the laboratory, and they're already used by science. And from a laboratory scale to a large scale, they cover a wide range of things.
Yes.
And I believe I sent you a copy of February 82, Science Digest, page 80, for anyone that doesn't understand how the interference patterns can cause the phantom transmitters. It shows exactly how two sets of ripples come together and produce additional mysterious sets of ripples that would mysteriously appear. Also, the March 84 Popular Science has an article on holography where they mention they make a hologram of a magnifying lens, and that hologram can be used to magnify light, although it doesn't really exist. It's a phantom or virtual lens, but it acts the same way as a real one.
Yes.
And that ties in with what you're saying.
Exactly.
Also, you can prove that the electrostatic field affects water molecules, which make up the clouds, by rubbing a comb with tissue paper and holding against the stream coming out of your water faucet. You'll see it'll bend or deflect the stream of water slightly, and that proves that a large static field can affect water molecules.
Yes.
But it's a long jump to modifying the weather, but it proves the principle.
Right.
So, anyway, another thing...
Craig, make me feel so dumb sitting here.
Well, I'm just clipping articles here, and ties in with what you and Tom have been saying. Also, the Register, Orange County Register, 52083, has a complete article on the Lita device, the Soviet little transmitter they set in a room, and it can tranquilize you with no wires hooked up.
Yeah, quite a discussion on that one night.
Working at the Veterans Hospital in Loma Linda, and apparently it's not a secret that the Soviets have been using it for 20 years.
Yes.
So you're saying they're just using it on a large worldwide scale and more power, right?
That's correct.
So that's real.
A lot of people quit calling me an idiot the moment they got a hold of the Lita device.
Right. Also, I was wondering if you could help any of us that would be interested in joining your network to monitor these signals around the country. I don't know anything about ham, but maybe some of the hams would be interested. Is there a way they can join up to your network?
Well, Craig, I don't have a network. I've just been operating independently and trying to share the information with everybody I can. I'd be happy to correspond with you and make you aware of papers, things like this, or send you copies of whatever.
Okay.
And if you find some of these signatures in the sky, please note the time, note the incident, draw a sketch or take a picture, and please write me a description. I'd very much appreciate it.
Last year I saw one, but I didn't have a camera in Orange County. A perfect circle thin cloud layer and a perfect hole through the clouds about a mile in diameter. That's a little different than what you described. It's sort of the opposite.
Yeah.
But it was a perfect circle, and that lasted for a few minutes near sunset. And I also felt several of the earthquakes, which the Navy and the seismic centers denied were earthquakes. They denied there was no military sonic booms. It was a slow rumble of an earthquake, and that came out in the paper here locally. I felt them.
Well,
there
were a lot of those around here
recently, from southern Tennessee all the way down to Florida.
Well, it's pretty unnerving knowing that ICBMs and all that nukniks are obsolete because they're both Brezhnev or whatever can push a button at the speed of light, send these energy pulses to zap us right in our beds without any warning or anything.
Well, you see, it's like every other weapon. For every weapon, there's a counter. For every measure, there's a countermeasure.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got to get our universities moving and our scientific community moving, and we'll very rapidly have countermeasures.
Okay. One other thing, you mentioned the firewalking. How does this explain any glass walking, where these yogis walk on razor blades or glass or eat glass without being cut? Is that a different explanation?
Yes, I'm not aware of how they do that. I did see a voodoo dancer in Haiti one time eat a glass, and I was standing 6 feet from him, observing extremely carefully. He was not doing any sleight of hand or anything. He took a glass off the table that my wife was drinking from, and he proceeded to eat that thing and chew it up with me watching the glass in his mouth on his tongue.
Mm-hmm.
He was never cut, nor was there any blood. And to this day, I don't know how that works.
Okay. On February 10th of Science this year, I had a two-page article on Joe Newman's free energy motor, and I wonder if you knew him. He's down in your area.
Yes. In fact, during the last few months, I've been exerting a great amount of energy and all the money I could afford to spend to send tapes of that interview to everybody that had any power to influence that court decision, that court case he's got coming up. I've been sending tapes to, a couple of congressmen, to some pretty powerful people that have a lot of influence and things like this all over the country, trying to get some help brought to bear, some pressure brought to bear when his suit comes up in June against the patent office and trying to get his patent.
Mm-hmm.
And it is working, Tom.
Yes, it is. He's got three working models down there.
That's great. I have your part four of your booklet, but there's no glossary of terms, and it's still quite difficult to understand the terminology. And the scalar wave part, I don't have any little test for that to understand that intuitively for myself.
Yes, I'm working on a glossary, by the way, for the new edition of the Excalibur briefing, if I can ever get it in and get it out, which I should get it in pretty quick, and it'll be out about August. And I will have a glossary in the Excalibur briefing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll let someone else get on now.
Okay, Craig, thank you very much for your call. Craig, obviously, is a bright young man, Tom. He challenges us all the time. Yeah, Barbara just stepped in here.
Yeah.
Barbara.
Fascinating show. What happened to our winter this year?
Well, ask the Russians.
Yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying the early summer that I think started about the time that fall began last year, but I'm wondering what it's going to do to our crops and so on.
Who knows?
I don't know. Well, I'll listen to the program. The next 15 minutes, you may solve that problem too. Well, I am going to be talking about some slightly different subjects. I think you know both of my guests tonight. Sandy Gooch, the owner of Mrs. Gooch's Natural Food Emporium, going to be in studio to tell us what we should be eating and what we shouldn't. Actually, her own life story is an interesting story, and maybe she'll share some of that with us.
I don't think she'll recommend eating a glass like...
No, I think... Well, actually, if it doesn't have sugar in it, if it doesn't have processed flour, she might go for it. No, I don't think so. And then in our 2 o'clock hour, and I do know, you know Bart Ellis, who's been a guest of yours, but he's going to be wearing a slightly different hat tonight. He is a mental health professional. And he's going to be talking about his feelings about warehousing the mentally ill, as he calls it, putting folks who are schizophrenic in hospitals. And he says it's simply warehousing them. He claims he has a better method for training schizophrenics and other seriously mentally ill people that can get them mainstreamed back into regular life. So we're going to hear a bit from him.
Well, Bart's a very, very bright guy, and I hope somebody pays attention to his thesis there.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed speaking with him on the phone, brothers. I have not met him in person yet, and I'm looking forward to that in the 2 o'clock hour.
Okay. Thank you very much, Barbara. Barbara Essenton. Be on right after the news at midnight for a whole night of kind of fun stuff. Barbara has a very, very good show. Let's go on with our callers. Tom Bearden is on the line from Huntsville, Alabama with us, and we have Carl wanting to know about the scalar waves. Carl?
Tom?
Yes, Carl.
I can barely hear you, but I'll go on. I've read considerable about Nikola Tesla in the past few years, and one of the measurements that he made was in a storm, the wave action, the electric wave action that went around the Earth, and he measured the amount of time and everything. And what I wanted to know was, is this in the same basic ELF type of frequency ranges?
No, Carl, it's not in the ELF, but the point you bring up is very interesting. Storms do produce scalar waves. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that produces ball lightning, the mysterious phenomena that used to be a fraud and now is accepted and known to be real, ball lightning, for example, is often produced because a cloud in the region and the ground or two clouds form a scalar interferometer, projecting scalar waves which, because of their randomness, form a sort of a circle. And you get a glowing ball of energy where the energy bottle is. And that's usually what produces the ball lightning from the clouds. Now, what Tesla detected in the Colorado Springs and caused a great deal of excitement when he realized what it was, he detected the waves from the storm, even though it was very far away, and he realized that what he was looking at was something extremely unusual. With his very agile mind, he immediately went from that on into the things where he demonstrated from Colorado Springs the fact that he could transmit a wave around the Earth and form a standing wave. If he had succeeded in finishing the tower that he was building on Long Island, Wardenclyffe, he would have given the world free energy with such a standing wave.
However, Wall Street did not like the idea.
Which is normal.
They figured energy was something to sell and something to tax. And so that ended that.
All right, I have two things I would like to find. One, there, in the last week or 10 days, there was that cloud formation over the northwest San Fernando Valley and in the Santa Susana Mountain Pass here.
Mm-hmm.
And... the other thing is that will all these books and stuff be available up there at the Tesla Book Company, the paperwork and stuff?
The electromagnetic series that I've been writing is available there now. The earlier paper that I produced on the Soviet Tesla weapons is available there. I have a videotape that's available for me at the post office box that I gave on the Tesla weapons. And the paper that I, when I can finish this thing on weather control, it will be available from John Ratzlaff at the Tesla Book Company.
Okay. And I recommend giving him a call. That address again is what, 1580 Magnolia?
Yes, and that's Millbrae, California. Instead of your normal magnetic wave, and you understand the scalar wave was two opposed waves, exact frequency, 180 out. Now, as you know, when you build a wave, you'll actually get a narrow bandwidth. And so you won't have just a single sine wave. What you should do with that thing is run it through a Faraday cage. The scalar comes out, the other stuff stays, the hash stays in. If you build a scalar wave and you find a resonance in that material anywhere, that material acts as a capacitor for the scalar wave. And you can charge the very atoms of the material itself up with this. This is an effect that Tesla noted also in an obscure paper. And you can get the mass and inertia of the object to change when you put a lot of charge, a lot of scalar charge into it that way.
Okay, Tom, well, keep up the work, and we'll try to do something down here.
Okay, right. And Bill One.
Bill One, let us know about it.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, Carl.
Night.
Night. Dave, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I read a book a couple of years ago called The Cosmic Conspiracy. I don't remember very much about it, but I remember it was dealing with Tesla and the work that he had done and the work that the Russians and the Americans had done from, you know, Tesla's original work. Got into the VLF stations in Antarctica. Are these the same as the scalar waves?
Well, the ELF that we detect is a normal kind of wave.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're using normal detectors.
Uh-huh.
It's been my thesis for some time that, you know, hidden from the normal detectors is the scalar components, and that's what's doing the real dirty work.
Mm-hmm. But are there actually these stations in Antarctica?
I don't know about Antarctica.
Uh-huh. It also got into a project, Noah's Ark. Have you heard of that?
No.
That was supposedly put together back in 78 or 79. Under the guise of some presidential protection thing, and people were raising questions that this was dealing with these scalar or ELF waves on, you know, being able to control the weather in various areas of the world. But
I'm not familiar with the book.
It was put out by an Australian publisher, and it'd be pretty hard to get. But
I'd love a copy of it.
Yeah, in fact, maybe if I can get a hold of this, you know, I'll write Tom.
Okay, very good idea.
Okay.
All right, Dave, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And are you way up there in San Francisco area again?
Yeah, Mariposa, right. First of all, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm sure you know what happened to Wilhelm Reich, since you mentioned him before.
Yes.
I'm sure nothing like that will happen to you, but do you suspect that at some point the government may step in to try to kind of squelch the kind of publicity you're bringing to this area of research?
I don't expect any particular trouble from the government because, you know, so far they haven't really believed it, except in obscure places.
What I'm saying is when they start to believe it.
When they start to believe it, and start to do something about it, I'll be very happy to shut up and let them do their job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question. We know that you know, different frequencies in the normal electromagnetic spectrum have different applications. Would the same be true with scalar waves?
Yes, indeed. Such fantastic applications, it's very difficult to describe in a few words. For example, if you understand a Fourier transform, a Fourier expansion, you can represent any kind of a shape, a reasonable shape, or by a Fourier expansion. And by two Fourier expansions, like the interferometer business, you can represent a three-dimensional shape. So you can actually build a wave that will actually go inside, and if you want to resonate with one particular kind of molecule or one particular kind of atom, you can pick the complex of frequencies that we know about that are connected with one kind of atom, for example. And you can go in and you can hit that atom. You can reach down into the nucleus, because the scalar wave will go through the Faraday cage of the orbital electrons, go right on down into the nucleus. You can enter the strong force reactions that binds the nucleus together, and you can actually transmute the element into something else. You know, Curvrol was nominated for the Nobel Prize in 77. He didn't get the prize, but he was a nominee for proving that living systems can transmute elements. And in fact, that's the way they do it. With a scalar interferometer they've got in their head, chickens, human beings, oat, wheat, barley, and everything which has comparable structures can actually transmute one element into another in a small fashion. And so you can do innumerable things. You can match almost any pattern and almost any shape and almost any interaction. You can bias the quantum level statistics. Instead of the quantum level being absolutely statistical, you can bias the statistics and change the probabilities one way or the other. And so you can cause, you know, any change that you can get by changing the collapse of the state vector and having different probabilities than what you started with. And that's an enormous application alone, just by being able to do that with these scalar waves.
Is all this information presented in the material that you've got published with the Tesla book?
Well, I'm putting it out as fast as I can. Not all of this is in there, but the gist of all of it is in there. And some of the mechanisms, for example, are in that Part 4 paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a paper now for the weather engineering. I have a rough outline, with some filled in, for the applications of a scalar theory of medicine, by means of which you should be able to do some rather enormous things in medicine. And it turns out that some of the older guys who were suppressed like Tesla did those things using scalar waves.
Mm-hmm. One last question. It seems to me this would also be very useful in the field of communications.
Indeed, because you can make waves that go slower than the speed of light, or you can make them that go faster than the speed of light. You can make waves that go through the ocean.
Mm-hmm. this is really kind of an endless vista here that you're opening up.
Well, that's what this show is all about, Craig.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I know you're about out of time, so I'll...
All right, Craig. Thank you very much for your call and getting
on. Nice talking to you, Craig.
Sure.
On
thank
the
you.
Line. We have time.
He included a document that he claims was signed between the United States and Russia about 1970. And it was an agreement between the United States and Russia not to use weather-influencing machines as offensive weapons. I wondered if you had heard anything about that.
I know there are some kind of agreement. There is some kind of agreement between the Soviet Union and the U.S. in the field of weather engineering, but I don't know the gist of that agreement.
Well, we know what the history of an agreement with the Soviet Union is. It means nothing.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, David, thank you. Tom, thank you very much for staying up late and electrifying us again with the Tom Bearden world.
Thank you, Bill. It's a real pleasure.
All right, Tom. We'll be checking with you later. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.